Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, March 21st, 2014. Peace talks are delayed in Addis Ababa as the two sides argue over the role of the recently released political detainees at the talks.
The problems started within the political bureau. We differed on issues of reforms and democracy within the party. So if you want to resolve this crisis, you've got to resolve the differences within the ruling party.
And tensions are on the rise in Upper Nile State between locals and Sudanese refugees.
Just the day before yesterday, when I was reading the reports, when I was talking with my colleagues on the ground, Maban was under the control of rebels. This morning, it was taken over by the government. So there's a lot of fighting going on.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The second round of peace talks in Addis Ababa has been delayed over the issue of who can participate. Mata van der Wolf reports for VOA, the Ethiopian capital, where negotiations were supposed to be underway today.
South Sudan's government made clear it doesn't want to take part in the peace process if a group of former high-ranking political leaders, whom the government detained after fighting broke out in December, joined the talks as a third party. Former minister and political detainee Deng Alor says without this group, the political divisions in the Juba government that precipitated the fighting remain and there will be no peace.
The problems started within the political bureau. It started with us. We differed on issues of reforms and democracy within the party. We insisted on reform. So if you want to resolve this crisis, you've got to resolve the differences within the ruling party.
After more than 3 months of fighting, the only achievement of the peace process has been a ceasefire, which has been repeatedly violated since January. International diplomats are losing patience and this week warned all the stakeholders there will be consequences for those who obstruct the progress. U.S. Special Envoy to South Sudan, Donald Booth.
If the government or any other actor tries to undermine the peace process and rebuff the IGAD heads of state, they will face consequences. The people of South Sudan expect renewal. They expect their voices to be heard in forging a more sustainable peace. Business as usual is not a viable way forward.
General Taban Dengai is the lead negotiator for the opposition, loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar. He says that unlike the government of President Salva Kiir, they are willing to talk with all concerned.
We shall discuss peace with whoever in the table. Government alone, we are ready to sit with the government. With the other political leaders, we are also ready. We hope for inclusivity, but if government insists, that it can only be us and they. I don't think we are joined peace because of other political leaders.
Civil groups also came to Addis Ababa this month to discuss how they can be included in the peace talks. Lona James, who heads the South Sudanese Women's Advocacy Group, says the people are suffering in the fighting and they too deserve a voice in making it stop.
Urge the IGAD mediators to accredit representative of civil society to the peace process as an important stakeholder, provide funding for their involvement, and to maintain a platform for dialogue between civil society and the conflicting parties.
Mediators from the East African Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, have not commented on the latest delay. Fighting has killed thousands across the country. Hundreds of thousands of people remain displaced, and there are warnings South Sudan could face a famine unless farmers feel safe enough to return to their homes and plant their fields. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
The UN Refugee Agency reports tension between local residents and Sudanese refugees in Upper Nile State's Maban County are boiling over. The UNHCR says many Sudanese refugees are fleeing their camps to other countries in fear. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency reports recent reciprocal attacks between South Sudanese residents of Maban in Upper Nile State and Sudanese refugees have forced up to 8,000 refugees to flee from the Yusuf Batil camp. UNHCR spokeswoman Fatoumata Lejeune-Kaba says the refugees since have returned to the camp, but tensions persist and have spread to the Doro and Kaya refugee camps. She says the villagers and refugees are fighting over limited resources, including wood, grass, and grazing land. She says the hostility between the two groups reached such a fever pitch recently that both groups set fire to each other's houses, tents, and granaries. She tells VOA the villagers themselves are suffering as much as the refugees.
They're not in any better shape than the refugees, and this is all due to the current situation. Maban is an isolated area with the fighting since December. It's been one of the hardest hit areas, and people can't just, whether it's humanitarian agencies or commercially, people can't just go in and out of the town. Just the day before yesterday, when I was reading the reports, when I was talking with my colleagues on the ground, Maban was under the control of rebels. This morning, it was taken over by the government. So there's a lot of fighting going on.
Maban County hosts 125,000 Sudanese refugees who fled from embattled Blue Nile State. The UNHCR says one-third of the refugee population is made up of small children, pregnant and lactating women, as well as the elderly, disabled, and people who are chronically ill. Fighting between government and rebel forces broke out in South Sudan in mid-December. Since then, instability and conflict in Maban County have disrupted the planting and harvest seasons. In addition, aid agencies are having great difficulty transporting food and other supplies to the region because of insecurity along the roads. Lejeune-Kaba says local residents are very angry over the growing food shortages. She says they are demanding that some 60,000 refugees in Yusuf Batil and Gendrasa camps leave within 2 months.
Realistically, we can't do it. The rainy season is coming. 60,000 people is a lot, and this Maban is an area where you can't move people fast. You need trucks, and we don't even want to get to that situation where people would have to be moved to, because it takes a lot to identify a site, the land on the sites we've identified belong to people. You have to negotiate with them for them to agree to take them in. And if they learn that there's been fighting, I don't think they would want to welcome refugees.
Lejeune-Kaba says the UNHCR is working with authorities and other humanitarian agencies to diffuse the tensions. Maban County is close to Ethiopia. She says the governments of South Sudan and Ethiopia have agreed to let the World Food Program bring much-needed food supplies into Maban through Gambela in Ethiopia. She says the food, which will be distributed to internally displaced people and refugees in the coming days, should help reduce some of the tensions between the refugees and locals. Meanwhile, she notes, insecurity and hunger are forcing more South Sudanese to flee into neighboring countries. She says Ethiopia currently is receiving an average of 1,000 South Sudanese refugees every day. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, reports that one of its staff members was killed in El Fasher, Darfur, yesterday. Najmuddin Salah Musa Bashar, a Sudanese national, was working as a storekeeper. He was hit by a stray bullet while on his way home from work. VOA's Kim Luiz spoke with Aisha Kambal of ICRC in Khartoum about the killing.
Our colleague Najmuddin Saleh Musa Bishara was driving home with three other people in a private car when he was hit by a stray bullet. He was very committed and we're extremely sad to have lost him.
Do you all have any idea who killed him?
The exact circumstances of his death remain unclear, but we are in touch with the police investigating the case.
Was he heading home coming from work?
Yes. He had left work and he was hit by a stray bullet while he was on his way home from work in a private car.
Were the other people injured?
Actually, we do not know the exact condition of the other three individuals.
I understand this is the second time in a little over a month that someone with the ICRC in Sudan has been killed. What was the other occurrence?
The other incident actually was for the Sudanese Red Crescent Society, where a volunteer died in a landmine explosion in South Kordofan.
With the shooting death of your colleague, is there growing concern of security in the area? And also, is this something that happens on a frequent basis with workers in the area?
No, this is not something that happens frequently for us.
Do you know what type of investigation will take place?
A police investigation is currently taking place.
So at this point, then the ICRC, they just have turned it over to the police and will wait for them?
Yes, the police is running an investigation currently. And at this point, we are also in the process of understanding what exactly happened.
That was Asia Kambal of the ICRC speaking with VOA's Kim Lewis from Khartoum. A rights group says civilians in Darfur are caught in the crossfire between government forces and rebels, as well as between rival militia. Human Rights Watch is calling on the Khartoum government to end alleged attacks on civilians and release demonstrators recently arrested for protesting the violence. Leslie Leskov is the group's deputy director for Africa. From Amsterdam, she told VOA's Joe DiCapua the violence in Darfur has sharply increased over the past month.
We're seeing a surge in government bombings and ground attacks on villages in certain areas of Darfur, like Jebel Mara, South Darfur. And then we're also seeing clashes by militia groups, which is a somewhat separate strand of conflict. Tens of thousands of people have been displaced. Scores of people have been killed. And it's a really worrying surge in violence against civilians.
Are you seeing this spread out over all three Darfur states?
It's mainly in North Darfur and South Darfur. But the other pattern that I want to mention is that the violence in Darfur has prompted protests in Khartoum, partly by Darfuri students, but also others. And what we've seen simultaneously is a crackdown on those protests, with Sudanese government forces using excessive force, lethal force, shooting protesters. One student died about a week ago, and detaining many, many people, including human rights activists.
Tell me how you're getting this information about what's happening to civilians in Darfur.
We have some people who are quietly gathering information for us on the ground. It's a difficult and dangerous job, but there are some very brave colleagues who are trying to do their best under difficult circumstances, given the access problems to Darfur and to Sudan more generally for human rights groups.
Tell me about some of the stories they've told you.
People describing the Sudanese Antonov planes circling near villages, dropping bombs, people being hit, including children being hit by shrapnel from these bombs while they're trying to flee. There was one terrible story of an attack in an area called Tijir in South Darfur, where there was first a bombing in late February, and then on the same day when an 18-year-old girl and two young boys went to try to get medical treatment after they were hit by the shrapnel, then government troops actually entered the clinic and started shooting.
What's behind the fighting between the militias?
There's been a pattern of clashes between different militia groups for the last year or more, which is partly on ethnic grounds, but it's also very much resource-related, where different groups are clashing over access to resources. One of the interesting facets of what we've been documenting recently is the name Musa Hilal, if that rings any bells. He has become a kind of notorious militia leader over the last 10 years in Darfur. He recently sort of defected from the government and is now kind of running rampant in Darfur and is also involved in some of these clashes. And apparently the government has been sending people to try to negotiate with him to bring him back in line.
You're saying Hilal was once connected with the Janjaweed, is that correct?
That's right. Musa Hilal was sort of one of the most prominent and notorious Janjaweed militia leaders in the early years of the conflict in 2004-2005. I actually was part of a Human Rights Watch team. We interviewed him in 2004 in Khartoum. But over the years, his allegiance to Khartoum has fractured. He left the government some time ago and has, for various reasons, maybe partly because promises were not fulfilled. But I think what this shows is the quite confusing picture we see in Darfur today, where there are different types of violence.
So it appears to be a very complex situation, perhaps even more complex than it was when it was just rebels against the government. So what should be done, in your view?
All along in Darfur, what we've seen is the Sudanese government either unwilling or in some times unable, but mostly unwilling to kind of take the steps that are needed. But having said that, I think there are still concrete things that the government can do. Part of the problem we see in Darfur is impunity, the government refusing to actually undertake meaningful investigations and prosecutions of people who commit serious crimes. Changes of some of these policies would help. You know, I think the other issue here, and this ties back to the protests in Khartoum, is again, we're seeing an unwillingness by the Sudanese government to actually deal with these often peaceful protests in the right way, and then covering up the really horrific crimes that have been committed. I mean, you know, there were 170 protesters who were shot dead in September in Khartoum, and the government has not dealt with this appropriately. They've just tried to censor the media, to deny the responsibility, and to cover up and ignore the need for justice.
Leslie Levkov is the Deputy Director for Africa for Human Rights Watch. From Amsterdam, she spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Sadly, sexual attacks on women occur in many circumstances in many communities, and the victims are not at fault. Sexual violence is a serious crime. Individuals that have been attacked should seek immediate medical attention. In addition to pregnancy, there are psychological dangers and the risk of sexually transmitted diseases such as HIV. That's why victims should seek medical help immediately. Physical and psychological trauma must both be treated quickly. It's also important that people do not blame the victims. Hopefully, with family and community support, the healing can begin.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we hear how South Sudanese poets are marking the International Poetry Day. Stay tuned.
For all the latest in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to Voice of America's South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 16:30 to 17:00 UTC. You can email us at southsudan@voanews.com. We are also on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcasts on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is your dream job?
A dream job to me is a job that will pay me according to what I have done, you know. What I am satisfied with is a dream job.
Of course, I want to be a media mogul. I want to run my own media house.
My personal dream in life is to continually participate in programs and projects that will develop the life of Nigerian citizens and the world over.
I'm dreaming that I should have to become a doctor. I was dreaming like that, but right now, it is now, I think, too late.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The treason trial of four SPLM officials in a special court continued in Juba today, with a third prosecution witness testifying against the accused. Thomas Dot, Director General for South Sudan's External Security, says he has solid evidence that the four detained politicians on trial planned an armed takeover of the government. Dot alleges that two of the accused, former Deputy Minister Majak Dagot and former security minister Oya Edenga Jack, told him they would force President Salva Kiir out of the SPLM chairmanship in order to strengthen the SPLM ruling party. That did not happen, nor did the alleged takeover, but clashes between soldiers in the presidential guard on December 15 touched off the crisis that continues today. Lead defense lawyer Monluak Alor says he is not concerned about today's testimony.
Cross-examination is a normal court procedure, and we are satisfied with the way we addressed our questions. So questions that we feel are relevant and that will help our case. We presented them all, and we will continue with the cross-examination.
Two more persecution witnesses are scheduled to appear on the stand before the defense takes over. Persecution lawyers declined to address reporters' question today. Roads leading to the courthouse remain open, although soldiers and police were deployed in and around the courthouse. That story was prepared by Philip Aleu in Juba. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. The hunt for the missing Malaysia Airlines plane continues to focus on the remote southern Indian Ocean, as Australian officials say there is no firm evidence so far that two objects spotted in the area by satellites came from that jet. Five search planes were combing the remote area as part of an international effort to locate possible debris from Malaysia Airlines flight MH370. The plane disappeared March 8th with 239 people on board. Russian President Vladimir Putin says for now Russia will hold off on imposing sanctions on the United States in retaliation for U.S. sanctions against Russia over the Ukraine crisis. The announcement came as Russia's upper house of parliament voted unanimously today to incorporate the Crimea region into Russia. The lower house approved the treaty yesterday, just 4 days after Crimean residents voted in a referendum to break away from Ukraine and join Russia. President Putin and Crimean leaders signed the treaty on Tuesday. And finally, Afghan Interior Ministry officials say eight civilians were killed when teenage Taliban gunmen opened fire in a luxury hotel in Kabul. Authorities said today at least one child and four foreigners were killed in the assault. Four Taliban gunmen were shot dead in the incident yesterday. Earlier, officials said at least two guards were wounded as guests scrambled for safety. Afghan security forces found the young gunmen hiding in bathrooms and shot them dead. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
Today is the World Poetry Day, a day established by the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, to enable people to appreciate the power of language and support the development of each person's creative abilities. In South Sudan, poets believe they can use poems to pass on messages of peace that will one day unite the country. For VOA News, Mungume Davis Rakarinj reports.
UNESCO adopted the day to support poetic expression and support linguistic diversity. The agency also believes poetry helps to shape dreams of peace, justice, and dignity.
Naganaga motoronaga nasi jere fikuruju nasi kulu geni fizere geni fetishu akulu nyekukat nutu fisika hibu jerewe alabu yala dugu lugara hilu kalina argusu adungu. It's talking about the rain. The rain is coming, and people are going to their fields, looking for food, while children are playing and enjoying the weather.
That is South Sudanese poet Gabriel Ernest Juma, who teaches music at Juba University's College of Music and Drama. In this poem, Juma sings about the beauty of the land of South Sudan. He says while it rains, parents go to the fields to look for food. Sometimes Juma turns his poems into songs.
Naga naga motoro naga nasi jerefi kuruju. Naga naga motoro naga nasi jerefi.
Juma says he started writing and reciting poems at the age of 13 at an IDP camp in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. His fans advised him to change from classical Arabic to simple Arabic so they could understand him better. Juma says he believes poems and poetry can have a big impact on society, including uniting a divided country like South Sudan.
I used to be hosted in SSTV or South Sudan television, and I presented many points, and many people like it inside and outside the country. They sent me messages and congratulations that the poem is very good, we like it. So I find that poem is one of the tools that can solve or can help us to build peace and reconciliation.
Taban Loliong teaches literature at the University of Juba. He says poems have always been part of traditional African life.
When we call it poetry, then we make people fear that it must be something which is taught in school, and especially in English, and which has rhymes, and so on and so forth. So in the traditional culture, we do have songs for various dances, dances for marriages, songs for dances that have to do with the spirit medium, and so on.
Poet and journalist David Luwate Lukani says he was inspired to write poems during an earlier time of peace talks, which led to the signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, ending the civil war between Southern and Northern Sudan in 2005. He says back then, he had hoped the CPA would bring long-time peace and stability to the entire region. His first poem was called Tears Will Be Wiped Away.
Eating it, nagon kemak ngoje momora du ijur lo kenyanu, ikinga alipan morek womun kanat. Ngotu ti Sudan leng aliangan, gwaja kumweju kogwan kuliati taling. The tears of our mothers will be wiped away as the leaders now sit in Kenya. The year 2005 brought happiness amongst all the peoples of Sudan, and there was dancing. And there was joy.
Despite the ongoing crisis, Lukan says not all hope is lost, and he believes poems can help lead the way.
Through poem, you can communicate messages of peace, messages of unity, messages of hope, you know, better future, expressing people's thoughts that what this country should be. It has a very huge importance in communicating the idea of nationalism, nationhood and brotherhood.
Professor Loli Leong agrees. He says when many African countries gained independence, poets played a crucial role alongside politicians. He calls them the Freedom Fighters Group Number 2.
What we need are politicians who are leaders, who will do great things, and then after they've done it, the poets, the singers, will sing songs in their praise. So it is the Freedom Fighters Group Number 1 who show us the way.
Both Lukani and Juma hope South Sudan will build more culture centers where they and other artists can perform and share their music and poetry. For VOA News, I am Mugume Devs Ruakarinj.
And that marks the end of our show for this Friday. We now leave you with a song, Dowironi by Emi J. Yore, singing about problems of in-laws in Western Equatoria. We have been listening to Emi J. Yore with that song, Dawironi. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening and join us again for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.